But I love this. The man who saved Wimbledon is Roger Taylor's autobiography. It is the untold story of a British tennis number one who fell out with his contemporaries whilst coming tantalisingly close to winning Wimbledon. How this working class lad from Sheffield reached three Wimbledon semi-finals and was twice US Open doubles champion is fascinating. It's a fascinating story. And I am really, really excited to say that Roger Taylor joins me on Late Night Joe. Hello, Roger.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
I am very, very excited. Well, first of all, have you pulled yourself away from watching Wimbledon at the moment, or do you not follow it every single day anymore?
I do follow it. I live very close to Wimbledon. I'm only about 300 metres from the nearest gate. But like, I've pulled myself away today to sit at home in a comfortable chair and talk to you.
I'm so flattered that you're doing that. And also, yes, you moved to Wimbledon when you were a player and you've not left. So you are literally part of that whole environment. And I suppose I should ask you this at the end of the interview, but I'm interested to know now. Do you envy the young players going in there, or do you feel, no, I had my place in the sun, it's now their turn?
Yes, I think I have to say that I think I had my place in the sun. Opportunities are different now. And even in my time, there were players, you know, that missed it before me. So I just, each period moves on. And the equipment changes, the atmosphere changes, the prize money changes. You know, it's a whole business now. So I'm delighted to watch it and enjoy it very much, and watching all the players.
And let them have their turn.
So it's
quite surprising, your background now, considering, you know, it's always considered quite a middle-class sport. You came from a working-class Sheffield family. In fact, I love your dedication in the book. You dedicate the book, or some of the book, to Weston Park, which is the local park, I think, in Sheffield, where you learnt to play. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. Well, my mother took up tennis when she was 33 years old. And I lived in a Coronation Street type area. Mm-hmm. So the park was the place you went. And mum went to play tennis, and eventually I got taken along, and I just run around the park. And I have a sister who was 1 year, 1 month older than me. We'd both, you know, run around the park. Life was different. Yeah, we're allowed to. You felt a bit safer, perhaps. I don't know what it was, but we're allowed to run around, and then occasionally hit a few tennis balls, but watched a lot of tennis as mum played.
Yes,
so
of
that's
course.
How it all started.
But if we talk about Sheffield, you know, from your background in the 60s, I mean, you would have been playing in the 50s and the 60s. Not many kids from your background would have been playing tennis and then actually spotted and encouraged to take tennis up as a profession. People need to read the book to get all the details, but can you just briefly tell us who gave you your break? Who was the person that said you need to come to London and you need to train professionally?
Yeah, I can. They had siftings, they're in Leeds, actually, and they invited a lot of young players to have a look at them. That was Dan Maskell, who was a national coach, and a new coach called George Worthington, an Australian, who took a liking to my game and helped me very much, and advised my parents that I should go to London. There's no chance if you stay in Sheffield, you cannot be a tennis player.
I think it's really interesting as well, because you came to London, but of course there was no such thing as a grant, there was no sponsorship. So you were, I found this so interesting because I love Fred Perry fashion. You were actually working for Fred Perry by packing his stuff in the great warehouses. That's how you supplemented your, well, you didn't have an income. Well, that was your income, basically, whilst you were becoming a professional tennis player. Is that right?
It is. So at 17, my parents allowed me to go to London. I'd been advised by George Worthington, you've got to go to London. And they so they arranged a job for me at Fred Perry Sportswear. And a pal of mine called Dickie Dillon from Sheffield and I went to London to, you know, conquer the tennis world. So we worked for Fred Perry Sportswear and we lived in the Wimbledon YMCA. There wasn't much accommodation, not many hotels. So we headed straight to Wimbledon when we got to London and we stayed at the Wimbledon YMCA. And that was a nice place to live. You got full board and you know, evening meals, etc. And in the daytime, we went to Piccadilly Circus and Fred Perry Sportswear was just off Shaftesbury Avenue. And that's where we spent our days. And we could, and we were allowed to play tennis. So we had to clock out and clock in those days. So, you know, if we were going to play a tournament, which were many tournaments in London, we were running almost out of the store.
And do you know, Roger, what's interesting about that is if you think of the players now, they are so nurtured. You know, they're, as you were a supreme athlete, but from the moment they wake up to the moment they go to bed, it's tennis, 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 tennis. Whereas you'd done a day's work, you know, and then you went and played matches. I mean, that shows how fit you were. And I'm jumping all over the place here because that whole, you know, I've read... other tennis players, autobiographies, and I've seen documentaries made about them. And it is, I always equate it to like ballet dancers who there is no room for anything else. That is your life, you know.
Yes.
You are literally, but for you lot, particularly for you, because as I say, you had didn't have wealthy parents, you had no one sponsoring you. Wasn't you? You know, it wasn't your daily bread. It was an add-on to you actually having to earn a living. When did you stop having to work for Fred Perry? When could you? When were you a professional tennis player?
Well, first of all, we had a weekly wage from Fred Perry's Sportswear, possibly ran to about £70 in modern exchange, and. We were allowed to play tennis. That was so important for us. We wanted to play tennis and we didn't get paid when we clocked in and clocked out. So we'd do other jobs in the office, in the warehouse. We'd do packing. We'd one day spend, they'd had two shops, one with the office where you could buy clothing, which they were just starting. And Fred Perry had, his name was bought by a guy called Tibby Wagner, who owned clothing businesses, and he presented him as and look how successful that's been. So anyway, so we kind of tried to play tennis and stay fit in between the working. So we'd run every evening, say around Wimbledon town. And then we.
Because there were no gyms, were there? Not like now when you go down the gym and pump iron. You had to find your own fitness, didn't you?
You did. And it is that's an interesting one because in the YMCA, they had one gym and it was a small gym. And if you went into that gym, there was one guy with every weight in the gym on a bar. And he was the one who got all the weights. And he was. You didn't go in there much, no. We weren't into that training, actually, so much. Nobody was telling us how to train. So we were just fit, as you say. We
ran incredibly fit, yeah.
We ran everywhere. We played tennis whenever we could. And in the weekends, we played in Wimbledon Park and we played in Fulham Park. Those two parks were where we played. But things, you know, were so difficult. We couldn't get any tennis balls. We didn't have any good balls. They'd wear out quickly and we couldn't afford more.
So you're playing with bald tennis balls and, and the tennis racket. Because now they'll take on eight rackets under their arm. What? You would not have had a choice of tennis racket. And you'd have been playing with wooden rackets, weren't you?
Yes, you were. You were. And things like that. And seeing if we broke a string in a racket, that was an absolute disaster get a restring. So you learn to restring your own racket.
No. Oh my goodness, that's hysterical!
And you did it with a different kind of like nylon was popular because it, you play in the rain, it wouldn't. It's like fishing line. Play in the rain and you never broke. And so,
you weren't playing with gut. You were playing.
No, eventually, yeah, but not at the beginning.
Roger. I mean, this is all in the book, everybody. So we're just jumping all over the place. You need to read the book, but we're just giving you little tasters. You were then, and I love this. And you still are a very good-looking man, Roger. But you were called one of the handsome eight. Who were the other seven? Were they all British players? And did you know you were called the Handsome Eight?
Yes, yeah. Well, what happened, 1967, it took me that long to get through Wimbledon to the later stages. You know, in the early days, I wasn't winning any matches, but then in the later stages, I got through to the semi-finals in 1967, and I get a phone call from an American guy who's putting together a new group, and open tennis, remember, it was amateur before 1968. So in 1968, open tennis came in where everyone was called a player. They weren't amateur or professional. So that was the start of the game opening up, which everyone had been waiting for. So I had the opportunity to go and play, but professionals got banned. And I knew that I was going to get banned in some way, but I still was going to take the chance because I could play with some of the best players in the world. So we had people like John Newcombe, Tony Roach, Dennis Ralston, Butch Buchholz, Cliff Drysdale, Nicky Pillage, Pierre Barthez, and myself. So every night I would have to play one of those guys in America. You know, we'd go around America and have to play one of those guys. And naturally, I started to improve from that. But the first couple of events were quite amusing because we started in Sydney, where the idea was that they'd sort of try and revolutionise the game and quicken it up a bit because of the long matches, long sets. So the guy who was the front man for the backer, Lamar Hunt, we had a huge clock on the court, a one-hour clock. And so you were going to play for money, not points. So if I'm playing against you, Joe, and I won the first point, it was $10 a point. Oh, so I'd get $10 for the first quarter. And that could go for 15 minutes. And you, meanwhile, are winning points as well.
Yes.
Second, you know, second one has got 20 points, second quarter. There's a big klaxon on the chair. Can you believe that? And we're playing for the first time ever in coloured clothing.
In coloured clothing. I love all that.
So sorry, running on the point. We go around to a complete match. So you could, that was a good format because you could play, and the last section, the last 15 minutes, each person could choose how much they wanted to play for, but they could also take a portion of the other player's money. So you had a chance to win. That was the first tournament in Sydney. The second tournament, we went to Kansas City, where Lamar Hunt is his hometown. He's the football, he's got one of these football teams. And the front man had forgot to book the arena. So this is a funny one because we now have to play in the cattle yards on ice. This is us. And we've come from we think we're good players. We think,
come from
we're
Australia.
We think we're good players. You know, we think we're women players. But what are we doing here? You know, so we're on the ice, an AstroTurf court just coming in. So they put this AstroTurf court down on the ice and there's a strobe light flashing all the time. So the matches were played and different point systems were being tried. But that's how the Handsome Eight came through. One journalist, a famous one in America, Frank DeFord, he was there and he nicknamed the group the Handsome Eight, and that's it.
Well, you were, though. You were handsome. As I say, Roger, you still are handsome. I love that. I mean, I can't believe playing on AstroTurf with flashing lights, but you carried on. You are also an honourable man, and I do mean this because, and I'm going to say this, because, I didn't know until I started reading your book about the boycott. And I mean, I was, those years, the 70 years, you, Rod Laver, Borg, Nastasi, those for me were the, they were the, I see, I can say this, it's like remembering vinyl, you know, they for me were the best years at Wimbledon. But I couldn't remember this boycott because it was a boycott in 76 or 73.
73.
And we need to say, I mean, so you broke the boycott, but this was not a political boycott. This was what seemed to me a ridiculous rule brought in by Wimbledon, whereby every player had to play a certain amount of matches. And this guy from Czechoslovakia didn't play the Davis Cup. Is that what happened? So he was, they were trying to boycott it because he hadn't played it. Is that right?
Nearly right, Joe. It's quite complicated that what happened. Wasn't Wimbledon that was banning anyone to start with? And, you know, they were just eventually upholding the rules. But it was a guy from Yugoslavia in that period.
Oh, right.
Yugoslavia.
Right. Yeah.
And the newly formed, you see, because the tennis was changing, so players were becoming, more... not militant, but they wanted more money. Everybody wanted more money all the time. So this was a start of let's take on. So the International Tennis Federation.
Oh, right.
They run the whole game. Every country was involved in that, and they would vote. So Wimbledon was just part of that.
I see.
So there was a vote. The guy was banned by his association. He was an amateur and. He was, you know, he got some fee for that, and he was going to go to another tournament, and he got more money, and so they took that case celebre, as we would say, and so now everyone's wondering. A year's going by, and people are avoiding the boycott because the players are already saying to tournaments, if you don't, you know, do what we ask, we're going to take all the players out of the tournament.
Right.
So in Paris and in Rome and in all, you know, the circuit, they had that power. So they come round to Wimbledon, and you thought, well, it's not really going to hit Wimbledon. But lo and behold, who was going to uphold the rules of the ITF, the Industrial Tennis Federation? And Wimbledon were. And so when then I was involved, then I was number one in Britain. I was a member of the club. I was playing for my country, which I loved doing. And I thought, well, I don't agree with this. I'm not going to boycott. And I was a little uncertain. It was a tough time.
And we need to say, Roger, because your dad was a union man, so you never say in the book whether he just said he'd support you, but being a union man, you must have been, because you say you had no idea when you went to bed that night whether you would boycott or play when you woke up
That's
in
right.
the morning. You had
That's
no idea.
And because phone calls were coming in from everywhere in the world. Became a huge, huge issue. So if someone would say, first one, play, go on, you must play, next phone call, don't play, next one, play, don't play. And this was going on all night almost. And, my dad was a union man, but he didn't try to influence me, no. But he knew what would happen.
Yeah,
he knew what was happening, and he did sort of say, you know, think carefully about what you're doing, obviously. And I just made that choice. I thought I was standing up to support my country, really, in a way.
Got
to that sort of situation with me. And I decided to play. So I was obviously going to get, lose a lot of friends and people that I'd known and travelled with all my life.
Gosh, what a dilemma, but thank heavens you did play as well. Can we also talk, and again, I'm jumping all over the place, but I've heard McEnroe give interviews about this, about how on that court you psych yourself up and, you know, the focus that is what keeps you going. And there's a wonderful example. Is it actually when you lose the semi-final, when rain stops play and you're playing Jan, who is Czech?
Jan Kodes, yes.
Yes, who's a Czech player. And this is the semi-final at Wimbledon, and rain stops play. And you go back to the locker room, and you assumed that you'd, that you'd all go back. But Jan had a sort of entourage. You didn't have an entourage, so he had people who were informing him, and you didn't. And am I right in thinking that you went back out, and that drive, everything had been broken, the spell had been broken, which it must happen, actually, when you go back to that locker room, and then you had to go back out again. Is that right?
It's, yeah, that is right. And sadly, you hit the nail on the head. I did lose that focus that you talked about. But it was a dark night. There was no roof on the centre court, so there was no lights. You couldn't play late, and the grass was already wet. It was raining, slippery, you know, all those kind of things. And we had to come off court. We came off court about 10 past seven in the evening. And then you thought, well, I thought, well, we'll never go back on. But we waited 42 minutes in the changing room. And finally, they called us back on. You know, it was very quiet. There was Jan Kodes and I became pretty good friends.
I was going to say, do you talk to each other in that situation, or do you sit in separate ends?
Not in that moment. No, we didn't. He was one end of the change room.
Yeah, I was
at the other.
Yeah.
But we always talk about it now.
So weird. And then you went back out and
then we go out again, and it's 42 minutes. And, you know, stupidly, I let slip, and it was 8 minutes later, I'm out of the tournament. In a way, it was sad, and it shouldn't have happened, and we shouldn't have been put out again. And those days, you focus, but you're kind of in a tunnel vision. You can't think straight.
No, so of course not.
You don't think of saying, oh, I'm not going out there to play.
You just do as you're told.
You just do as you're told, yeah.
Exactly, and that's how times have changed. Talking about, you know, how times have changed, I want to bring in this story as well, because this story is fascinating. And this is when you were playing Borg. And again, tell me if I got this right or wrong, but there was a call that Borg objected to. He thought it was what do you call it in tennis, a bad call or something. And you, this is why I say you're an honourable man, even though the umpire had given you the point, you said, OK, let's just play it again. I mean, unbelievable that you did that. And that was against Borg, am I right?
Yes, you are. And that was in the quarterfinals. And it was a match point. I'd got to match point, actually. I served, and the ball was out, you know, just out. So I think you know they're out. You know, you can't. People look and pretend, oh, that might have been in.
Because there was none of the technology that there is now, was there? I mean, you relied on the linesman.
Yeah, umpires and linesmen. So I knew it was out. So I served the first serve, match point, and we played for nearly 5 hours, I suppose. And I started to turn back to serve my second serve, and the umpire called game, set, and match, Taylor. So Borg knew it was out, so he held his position. I knew it was out, and I'm trying to indicate to the umpire it's out, and he didn't want to know. He said again,
extraordinary.
Game, set, and match, Taylor. And I turned away, and I turned and served again, and I lost that point.
Oh, my gosh. I hope this is on film. I'd love to see this.
We went back to juice, and obviously continued, and I did win the next 2 points and win the match.
Honourably, as I say. But, I mean, you were so generous. We've run out of time. We've overrun, actually. I could talk to you forever. It is such a fabulous book. But I know you won't say this, but I've already insinuated that you were playing when the greats were playing. For me, the personalities, I was saying to my producer, and you'll hate me saying this, Roger, that I can't name that many people who are playing this Wimbledon. And yet in the 70s, I knew every single person out there. I used to go every year, and my favourite place was by the practice courts. I used to watch everyone and see them going up the ladder or whatever. Am I right? Were there bigger personalities in those days? Were you allowed to show your personalities?
Well, there were characters.
Characters,
and
characters
like, of course, McEnroe, we know, won. Nastasi was one. And they were the best players in the world. That was a problem for you as a player, me as a player. They were the number one in the world, and they got a lot of, they made the crowd laugh. Let's just put it that way. They could just do anything. The crowd could laugh at some incident that they were arguing about. You know, the rules have tightened up now so much that you can't say so much. But there wasn't too much unpleasantness. Not everybody got on. And, you know, people like Nastasi was number one in the world for 5 years.
And can I ask, finally, I promise you, I keep saying finally, there's just so many things I want to ask you. I don't know if you read Agassi's autobiography, which was fabulous. It was like yours. It was a wonderful read. But he said something in it. And I wonder whether you could relate to this. He said in the end, he hated tennis. You know, he went out because he had to, and he, you know, he had to earn money, but he hated it. Could you understand that? Or is that what happened to these young players? I mean, he was a different generation to you. Do you think your generation still loved every match?
I do. He came up, you see, with his father, and now what's happening, parents are involved in a different way. They want their children to be superstars, and they want them to win. And, you know, like the, even the Williams sisters, the father was driving them on.
Yeah, hothousing them.
Yeah, and very intensely. We didn't have that. You know, you just had a, your parents might say bad luck, love, you know, that's it. If you lost a match, and you'd get on with the next one.
Yeah.
But no, in the end, I loved it. I loved playing. I loved the atmosphere. I was starting to play very well. It took me a long time, and I was very happy, yeah.
And don't say any more because people need to read the book. My final question, I promise you, this is literally the final question. How often do you get out there on the court now?
Not very often. Not very often, no. It's I'm fading away from playing. I've played all my life. I'm 83 this year. So I've played all my life and now I'm just winding down.
Honestly, Roger, I was never an athlete like you, but I used to love playing tennis. And I'm 70, but I just couldn't run for the ball like I could. Yeah. You know, you have to, at some point, you think, I just have to stand at the net because there's no way I can run anymore.
It's the movement, yeah.
It's the movement.
It's the movement. But I ended up playing in the, age-wise, I got into the super seniors.
Wonderful. What an accolade. Listen.
It wasn't based on talent, just
being old determination and age.
Yeah.
I have so loved, this has been my Wimbledon, actually, speaking to you, Roger Taylor. Thank you so much. Can I urge people to buy the book? It is out now. It's called The Man Who Saved Wimbledon. And we've only skimmed the surface. There are so many more anecdotes. And if you're a tennis fan, as I know many of you are, or if you just love your sport and you want to know what goes on in the head of these extraordinary players, then I urge you to read it. Roger Taylor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Joe.